Hello and welcome to the As Yet Unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 15th of October 2017. My name is DRP Watson, and this time I'm joined by Gareth James and Johnny Fox. We're now going to talk about Wings at the Young Vic. This is Arthur Coppett's play from 30 years ago. We're talking, 1976 was the original radio play, and it was first put on stage in 1978, in fact. So it is quite a long time ago. They don't mention the way that it was handled in this production, in sort of the Wikipedia, so I'm not entirely sure. What we have with Wings is we have a direction by Natalie Abrami, and she has re-teamed with Juliet Stevenson after they did a rather impressive Happy Days, Samuel Beckett's play, at the Young Vic, which was, I thought, was pretty good, although it was slightly marred by the fact that by the end of the play, Juliet Stevenson was completely trapped and had to ignore everybody filing out as the lights went up, which slightly put a dampener on that play. In this one, we have a major physical difference because we're telling the story of a woman who is an aviator. She's named Emily. She's always been independent. She suffers a stroke which destroys her ability not only to express herself and tell people what's wrong with her, but also affects her sense of reality. And we get fragments of her life coming at her, and we see scenes from her life and her recuperation. It is done here in a design by Michael Levine, in this traverse staging with some very impressive wire work. Juliet Stevenson is attached to a set of wires and spends most of this play flying up and down the stage. And it's really quite impressive, if only because she's obviously done a lot of yoga and got a very impressive core going, because although you sometimes wonder if she's being spun around by some artificial means, quite a lot of the time it looks as if she's fully under control and she's doing the spinning with her body, which is a rather impressive feat for anybody. She's joined in the cast by Lorna Brown, Kelly Bryan, David Hemmings, Nicholas Gasson, Richard James Neal, Emily Mitten, Mary Sheen and Emily Watcher. It's a shortish play, straight through, with a dreamlike feel to it. I mean, obviously, it is one of those plays which is about the mind, and you have people confused, and therefore you have this dreamlike quality. The way that they integrate the flying, I thought, was extremely impressive. But that is perhaps part of the problem with this play, because although it is a very impressive performance, the flying rig sometimes feels a little bit like a gimmick, but it is extremely well done, and I thought very effective and very good at illustrating the way that her mind is breaking down and the way that she is distanced from the other characters, because all the other characters, of course, are on the ground and not able to communicate with her because she's always flying around, and it's only when we see her begin to recover that she's actually more on the ground and talking normally and interacting normally with people. I thought it was a decent play. It's a very good performance from Juliet Stevenson, and I was very impressed by it, but I was a little bit worried that it might be all about the flying and the play by itself is not there. And like I said, I did wonder if the flying part of this has always been in the play and the wire work that was expected. What did you think about it, Gareth?
I don't know much about Arthur Coppett's work, except his work for musical theatre. He actually wrote the books for three musicals, for Nine, for High Society and for Phantom, not the Andrew Lloyd Webber one, but the Murray Easton one. But apart from that, I've never really seen anything of his on stage. And this, of course, did start out as a radio play and then was turned into a stage play sometime later. And it's quite a complex examination of the effect of a stroke, and in particular of asphasia, the sort of speech effects. And I suspect for 30 years ago, it was really quite ahead of its time. And I think my problem with it is that I'm not sure it's a great play. I mean, I think the production is very inventive. And I think the idea of having Juliet Stevenson's feet not touching the ground much and having her on wires the whole time is very much director Natalie Abrami's idea. In the reading I've done, it didn't give me the impression that's how they'd done it before. And in that sense, although it's very inventive staging, there's a moving platform and there are translucent curtains and very clever lighting. And I think between all of those things, I thought it was actually very inventively staged. And Juliet Stevenson, you know, does give a virtuoso performance. She is a fine actress anyway, but I don't know whether she's ever been an acrobat, but for a fine actress, she makes a good acrobat. And I thought that was also great. Everybody else, though, is really seems like an extra. So everybody else around her doesn't really get much of a look in, to be frank, and it's very much her show. And even though we get an interesting kind of peep into what it must be like, the confusion, the frustration, you know, being in a kind of nightmare of having a stroke, that's just about all we get, really. And we see medical examinations, we see therapies, and there are other characters who have similar situations. And it's often kind of intentionally in a sort of jumbled up way. So you're kind of getting an insight into this condition by seeing it through the way she's seeing it, I guess. And as you say, it's only 75 minutes long. But even though it's only 75 minutes long, it seemed to me a bit relentless, which sounds a bit odd for such a short play. So it's an interesting piece. I'm glad I went to see it again, largely for the performance and the staging. But I don't think it's a play that in any other respect, I would say, was worthy of revival now. We've had other plays which have helped us sort of see conditions like this. You know, we had Florian Zeller's The Father, which helped us see dementia through the eyes of the father in a very clever way by messing with our heads. And that's the kind of territory it's really trying to occupy. So, you know, an interesting play, not regretting going, but not something I could honestly recommend to anyone else.
We're now going to talk about What Shadows by Chris Hannon. This is a play directed by Roxana Silbert and concerns Enoch Powell. Enoch Powell is played by Ian McDiarmid, and we also have in the cast Nicholas LaProvost as Clem Jones, his close friend, Joanne Pierce playing his wife, Pamela, and also Paul Wilcox plays Marjorie Jones, who's Clem Jones' wife. We also get Amelia Donker, Waleed Akhtar and Amit Sharma as various more fictional characters. This play is set in two timelines. In one, we are just before Enoch Powell's famous or infamous Rivers of Blood speech. We have events kind of leading up to that. And then we also get a later time where one of the characters seems a child in this is now an academic and is looking for a talk with Enoch Powell. This towards the end of Enoch Powell's life when he is weaker and out of power. Gareth, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Well, I guess the fact we're seeing a play that revolves around a speech that was made to 90 people 40 years ago tells you something about the significance of the speech. The speech, of course, has gone down in history as the Rivers of Blood speech, although he never used the words Rivers of Blood. That was a paraphrasing by the media. But it did have extraordinary impact at the time and still has impact today. And I think it's, if anything, more timely today, given the sort of debate around immigration that we've been having in the last year or two. The play, as you say, moves between the time the speech was made and then this more fictional 1992 setting. The device is that a young black girl, one of the constituents in 1968, is now an eminent academic and historian. And in 1992, she's seeking to write about this speech. So she's kind of linking together her career with her personal history. And she would like to meet him and talk to him as part of that process. The speech clearly isolated him from a lot of people, and in particular had a very negative effect on these best friends, Clem Jones, who was a journalist, and Marjorie Jones, his wife. And we also get a glimpse of the effect on his constituency as well, where the debate rages about immigration there. And clearly, you know, Powell is a very intelligent man and a very well-read and erudite man. And it is kind of odd, you know, for a man like that to be, in my opinion, to be making a speech like the one he made. And when we get to the confrontation between Rose and Powell, it's a very interesting discussion, but it comes too late and doesn't last long enough, really. Then that was the problem I think I had with the play. Two other problems I had with the play. One is there's a character who Rose goes to meet in Scotland who was a historian, and the implication is that she was kind of hounded out of academia by Rose and others accusing her of racism. And she kind of teams up with this woman in her quest to write about the Rivers of Blood speech and Enoch Powell, which seemed very implausible to me. And the other thing is, at any time, it doesn't put forward the more cynical view that I have, that, you know, he's a politician, and this may well have been a grab for attention, if not power, in a kind of Boris and Brexit way. And, you know, and it doesn't actually sort of mention that. And if that were the case, clearly it misfired because it isolated and ostracized him, and it didn't quite finish his career because I think he ended up in Northern Ireland, didn't he? But anyway, I think that's one of the theories that isn't put over. So I thought it was, I mean, we seem to have an appetite for plays about recent history. And I, in the last few weeks, really, have been to see Oslo about the Palestinian-Israeli secret peace talks, Inc., about Rupert Murdoch's acquisition of the Sun, and the same playwright, James Graham's Labour of Love, about the recent years of the Labour Party. I think this one wasn't as entertaining as the others. The others were just as interesting as history, but they were more entertaining, and this is more uneven and more earnest. But I thought, you know, it is an interesting subject, and it was a welcome addition to that kind of, to the history places, we'd probably be calling them at some point in time. And indeed, the central performance by Ian McDiarmid as Powell is absolutely mesmerising. I think it's absolutely brilliant. And that, to me, was a very good reason on its own to see it. But it does provoke a lot of debate. I mean, we did have a debate with the people I went with, and there was a Q&A after the show, which was very interesting, where the sort of audience inputs, particularly the differences between those that were around at the time and those that weren't, I thought. So I thought an interesting play, but not the best of the history plays. But I'm glad again that I went to see it.
My biggest problem with Ian McDiarmid's performance as Enoch Powell was just how good it was, because his accent was so Enoch Powell and so accurately reflected him that actually it became difficult to follow what he was saying a lot of the time. It just felt so exact, and sometimes you lost the actual words he was saying, which I did have a slight problem with. I mean, but it is a bravura performance by him. The thing, if you're going to be charitable about Enoch Powell, and I don't particularly want to be charitable about Enoch Powell because I think he did a lot of damage with, you know, with this speech, was that there is always that genuine thing with immigration, is that although from a macro point of view, immigration is generally a good thing because you're getting in lots of interesting people who enrich the country, on an individual level, on a constituency level, it might not be seen as a good thing. Even today, you get large numbers of Polish people coming into an area, and it's not the idea that they're swamped, but in the case I recently read of an area which has had an influx of a few thousand Polish people, the companies, the firms, the employers like them because they can more or less speak English, and they tend to be better motivated and better educated than the locals. And the locals feel aggrieved because they feel left out. And I think that this is something that hasn't been voiced, and something that may indicate why half the people, just over half the people, wanted to get out of Europe. And it's a feeling of being left behind and being left out, and feeling that, yes, okay, they aren't damaging the country, they're not actually causing any damage, they are actually enriching the country, but we're being left out. You know, that idea that a certain section of people are being left behind, that in order to keep them happy, we are forgetting about some people, and those people would say, but we are, you know, we are exactly like you, why are you leaving us behind? And I think that's, if you're doing it charitably, that's what he's trying to voice, and you get that impression that that is what he's trying to voice. The problem is, of course, that having voiced this in his Rivers of Blood speech, he then, voicing the support for, I don't want to say the native people, but it's that sort of thing, he's standing up for the native English people rather than the incomers. Having made the Rivers of Blood speech, he then went on and lent into it. He was always the big bogeyman talking about the dangers of immigration from then on. And it almost became a one note. And you may well be right, because he was sort of tipped for the top. He was somebody who people liked, and they probably liked him a little bit more than they liked Edward Heath, because Edward Heath was a bit strange. And he does seem to have been a very remarkable man. I mean, he was a very young professor before the war, and then he became a brigadier general by the end of the war. He never actually fired a shot in anger. He worked in intelligence, and not the actual, you know, the fun bit of spying, but gathering information and doing lots of planning. So he was close to a lot of people, and he was over in India during the campaign in Burma and things like that. So he is a fascinating guy, and we get a lot of that. I think one of the things that the writer is trying to put across was that the immigrants do tend to become British by the end of it, because when, you know, Powell encounters this young academic, he says, well, what do you think British is? And she just makes the up yours symbol, the fist raised and you hit the bicep. She makes that, and he says, yes, that's exactly what being English is. And that's the sort of idea that, because he was saying that, you know, they are so different and they will never be part of us, but of course many of the communities do become that, and there is no difference, and we have changed to meet them, and it has been a good thing, because of course immigration is a good thing from a macro point of view, but it's the individuals and the individual constituencies that we don't. We get a parallel story here of his constituents. We have a slightly racist woman who actually marries an Indian, and then as she suffers from Alzheimer's by the time we get into the 1990s, she's forgotten all about him, and he has to try to convince people that he is actually her husband, and they did get married, and she is somebody who is not exactly sympathetic towards the immigrants, although she tolerates them but doesn't like having to tolerate them. That is an interesting story. Done again, and a very nice performance, I thought, by Paula Wilcox. So, yes, it's an interesting play. I would have liked it to have been a lot better, though. I think it needs to have been... there's probably a greater play to be written about Enoch Powell, and I'm not sure that this was it.
I think it's interesting, I mean, your comment that the debate about immigration and jobs, etc., has been a bit buried. And of course, we're now living with the consequences of that, because those people had their say in the end in a thing called a referendum. I think that the situation is more complex and very different from that. I mean, I have sort of firsthand knowledge of organisations that are employing a lot of East European people, and their attempts to employ others have failed. So I think it's a much more complex story than that. But here we are, you know, history becomes reality, because in effect, I think that Brexit has got a foundation in the fact that, you know, people had these views because we never had the debate. So interesting. I think the depiction of the constituents and the ethnic minorities in this constituency, though, were a bit caricatured and stereotypical for me. I think that was a bit disappointing in the play, because I think that that didn't do the arguments justice, really. Anyway, I think we're on the same page in that it's worth seeing, but flawed, perhaps.
We're now going to talk about Labour of Love, which is a new comedy by James Graham, directed by Jeremy Herrin at the Noel Coward Theatre. It stars Martin Freeman and Tamsin Gregg, who has taken over at short notice from Sarah Lancashire, who had to drop out. The cast also includes Rachel Sterling, Dickon Tyrrell, Kwong Loke, and Susan Wacoma. It is a play about the Labour Party. We start in 2017 with the Labour MP David Lyons and his agent, Jean Whittaker, worried about what is going to happen in the outcome of this year's election. We then move back through the years, mainly when the Labour Party is in opposition, it has to be said. We only get one scene when they are actually in power. I think it's the 2001 general election, so we don't get anything from there. But we are usually focusing around about election time on this constituency in the Midlands. We are D.H. Lawrence country, Nottinghamshire, Mansfield, places like that. And we go back as far as 1990, which is when David Lyons gets elected for the first time. He's kind of been parachuted into the constituency from central office, which puts various people's noses out of joint. Jean Whittaker is the wife of the former MP, who has retired through ill health, and she reluctantly agrees to become his agent. Having got backwards in time in the first half, in the second half, we then start going forwards in time, and we get the sequel to each scene, or the next, if you treat them as acts, you get the sort of the next scene in the act for each time period. We walk through the various elections and other times when they are gathering. John, can you tell me more about this play and what you thought of it?
I think I really, really liked it. And I have to do a little bit of declaration of interest. Because even as a kid, I really loved election nights. We always watched the results tot up on television, you know, even in black and white, I think, in my dressing gown. And then later, when my parents were involved in local politics, I would go with them to the count. And in my own right, I have to confess also that I once stood for election. And I'm not really sure which I enjoyed better, either the night I was elected as the youngest member of Southampton City Council when I was 22, or 3 years later when there was a landslide in the other direction and I didn't have to do it anymore. And I think there's a surfeit of election nights in Labour of Love, possibly enough even to dent my enthusiasm, because I enjoyed watching them spiral back in the first act. And then when the same ones came up in the second act, I was a little bit underwhelmed, even though new things are revealed in the second act, which is very good. But we're backwards and forwards between about Kinnock and Corbyn, aren't we? And Martin Freeman's bright boy Blairite, David Lyons, gets in, I think, on a by-election. And he's also then caught in the trap between that eagerness for power that everyone who stands for office has and the relentless stream of wearying complaints from his constituents. So he relies on his agent, the doughty Jean, as you said. She is a hereditary member, if you like. I think that's the best way to describe it, from the days when anyone from the working class, anyone with a flat cap or a whippet or an outside toilet, automatically followed the red flag. And that's before Blair revitalised the party in a different direction, changed the marketing, changed the red flag to a red rose. And as Jean says, although this is not James Graham's original joke, because like New Labour, it looks pretty full of pricks. So the structure fascinated me. And I wonder if he tried to adopt something Shakespearean in this. And I'm sure he cudgelled his brains to see if he could turn Love's Labour's Lost into a modern Labour comedy. But he couldn't. And so he's resorted to Much Ado About Nothing. And so you get the idea of a very Blairite Benedick and a Benite Beatrice in a comedy courtship. So it's a tiny, tiny bit obvious, because I think you know from fairly early on that Jean's interest in David is more than just supporting him politically, fighting with him politically. And whilst James Graham's script takes us a way, way beyond the sort of easy political quips you might get in a TV comedy, you know, have I got news for you situation, it's not quite the wonderful inside job he made of this house. And here I just want to chart the rise and rise of James Graham, because he's a writer I admire very much indeed. And he got off to a very fine start with this house because it was given a wonderful production by the National Theatre. And now he's being lauded because he has two plays on the same street as we're discussing Labour of Love at the Noel Coward. Just a few hundred yards down the road, the Duke of York's, you've got Ink, his play about how Rupert Murdoch took over the Sun. So he's immersed in this kind of theatrical meets politics background. And I'd love to know where he does his political research. And he's obviously got some people who are telling him lots of interesting home truths. This production was beset by a cast change, as you mentioned. Sarah Lancashire was unwell. I think from almost the first read through, it was evident that she wasn't going to be able to do it. And then, you know, who do you look for to play a sort of northern working class Labour character? And Tamsin Gregg is just not one of the first names, one of the first 10 names I would have thought of. She is an excellent actress. She can turn her hand to anything. And I think there is a look of her turning her hand to this, because when Sarah Lancashire pulled out, I'd first have found someone like Nicola Walker, whose work in Last Tango in Halifax pretty much redefined that chip on the shoulder, cardigan wearing northern acting for the post-Priestley generation. And Gregg, it's just not her natural constituency, to pick a political reference. She has this elegant, sophisticated angularity you just can't cover up. You can't make her with frumpy clothes look and behave and posture like I think this character was originally written. She is never less than totally credible, though. And many of the lines are polished even brighter because she has perfect sense of comic timing. But when the plot develops and Freeman's character eventually realizes what she means to him, it felt more strange than the author intended that he didn't spot this earlier in what was really quite an attractive woman. That's one very small thing that doesn't work perfectly for me, although I do admire her tremendously and she is very, very good and will probably get some kind of Olivier Award for it. Someone who won't is Rachel Sterling. You know, again, a very good actress, plays David Lyons' wife. She's written as a successful lawyer, very cheery Blair, of course, but also written as a heartless bitch. And it's played as a cold, heartless bitch who seems to have no affection at all for what David is doing. And I heard in this a little bit of the dissent that you get in the movie of The Queen, where Helen McCrory playing Cherie Blair is quite sarcastic about Tony's ambitions and dissenting when he wants to do anything that makes him interact with the establishment. But Rachel Sterling's character is more selfish than that. She is more not socially climbing, but you know, she has a career to build as well, and she wants nice restaurants and clean situations and doesn't particularly want to waste her time in a grubby committee room in what might be Mansfield. And I couldn't tell whether that was a bit of uncaring scripting, that Graham didn't write the characters, the peripheral characters, as clearly as he did the two central ones with whom he's very involved, or whether it was just directorial interpretation and this is how Rachel Sterling and director Jeremy Herrin worked it out. Either way, I thought it was less well drawn than this, and I think a lot of the peripheral characters are quite underpowered. The design is excellent. I really wondered how they were going to do all these subtle changes of wigs and accoutrements and so on. But Duncan MacLean, the director, used a front cloth on which he presents a lot of archival TV footage as a successful election dates move backwards in time and forwards in the second half. And they have done the costume and hair changes really sleekly. And also that you spot lots and lots of, oh, yes, we had one of those things in the older scenes. And you get lots of pointed differences between, you know, black and white television in the early elections and then the colour flat screen with people you recognise like Laura Koonsberg and Dimbleby talking about the election. And then there's quite a clever scene that relies on what you might call the nostalgic whir of a fax machine. And that contrasts with the most modern one where ping, there's a text from Tony for David. So I really enjoyed it. I think it is not quite as perfect as either This House or Ink, but I definitely think James Graham is on an electoral roll and can't wait for his next episode.
Yes, I was slightly, actually, speaking of set, I was a little bit disappointed when I worked out actually how they did it at the end, because I was up in the gods and you suddenly saw, oh, that's how they're doing it. There is not one set, but two.
Yes, it's real.
Yeah. And it's a very clever, and I thought that was very, you know, it's very clever to do it like that. So you can,
yes, you know, it would be,
because it made it very fast.
When this goes to amateur, there'll be a stage management team of 150 having to support that cast, whizzing everything around between the scenes.
I agree with you mostly on this piece. I was a little bit disappointed because, I mean, a lot of this is James Graham working out his problems with the Labour Party, but it's almost always the Labour Party in opposition. And I had a slight problem with that because the Labour Party, this is set over 27 years, and the Labour Party was in government for half that, or almost half that. And it's a little bit disingenuous to say, oh, yeah, we're always in crisis and they're always horribly going wrong and we're always split. And even in, I'm thinking of 2001, even there, you still get this tension, and the tension, they say, is between the Social Democrats and the Democratic Socialists, which you see throughout this. But yeah, it's very nice central performances, as you said. And yeah, you're right, the other characters are kind of underwritten. He's really only interested in these two people. The central performances, I mean, I was very, very impressed by Tamsin Gregg and by Martin Freeman, especially about how they went through it. But I see what you mean about Tamsin Gregg being a bit too polished and a bit too, well, I'm not going to say upper class, but a bit too polished to be this northern woman, this wife, who's sort of this long-term Labour person.
She didn't look like she had five kids either.
Yeah, exactly. So, very impressive. Yes, I slightly prefer Ink. I think this is doing slightly better than Ink, because I think this is it's a place for Labour people to go to lick their wounds, which is part of what this play is about. And I think it works quite well, but I don't think it's his best play. I think there are much better plays from James Graham.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.